There are a lot of things we take for granted about our health, I think. And when you think about how vital your eyesight is to so many aspects of light, the thought of losing it is very scary. But as many as, 100,000 people in Wisconsin alone are facing that reality. Our guest is going to talk about how to keep our eyes healthy, what treatments are available for those who are blind or have a vision lost. Dr. Dave Gamm is both a clinician and a researcher. His clinical practice is in pediatric ophthalmology, and his research interest focuses on human retinal development and disease, and he directs the University of Wisconsin Eye Research Institute. And Dr. Dave Gamm, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much. It's very, very good to be here.
Well, let's talk first, all right, blindness. And by the way, I've had some problems with my own eye, and so I have come to think a lot more about eyes and eyesight. And blindness is a terrifying thing. At one point, I was thinking I was going to lose my eyes, vision in at least one eye. What are some of the common causes of blindness?
Well, I think you, first of all, hit on the fear that goes along with losing your vision. Consistently, when you do polls to patient populations and you ask what they're most afraid of, cancer usually tops the list. Mm-hmm. But right behind that is losing your vision. So it is not uncommon for folks to spend a lot of time thinking about that. And in terms of the types of diseases that can rob you of your eyesight that are becoming increasingly prevalent, probably tops on that list is age-related macular degeneration, especially with the aging of the population.
Yep.
This is a disease that we don't have a great handle on right now, and it's a major focus of the research being done at the McPherson Eye Research Institute here at UW. That is, as the population ages, is becoming increasingly prevalent. It's really one of the major health problems that's facing us in the next 40 to 50 years.
Well, yeah, I suppose, you know, as we live longer,
mm-hmm.
I mean, we're living a lot longer now than we even probably 25 years ago.
Exactly. All diseases that are more common as you age are going to become more important as the society ages in general, and AMD is, or macular degeneration is one of them. But in addition to that, we're staying more active, and we're in the workforce later. So this has an economic and societal impact that's really increasing as well.
Talking today with Dr. David Gamm about maintaining healthy eyesight, talking about blindness and what we can do to keep our eyes as healthy as possible. Certainly, I'm looking forward to hearing from you and already some callers online. If you would like to join in, are you someone close to blind yourself, or have someone a close relative or friend who is or is living with a vision impairment? What questions do you have about eye health? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Your particular interest, research interest, interests me, as a matter of fact. It's pediatric ophthalmology. What are some of the most common concerns when dealing with children's vision? I have an 11-year-old, so, you know, this is...
Well, I mean, like most of the diseases we work with, it ranges in severity. There's very common disorders that we can deal with fairly readily right now. Amblyopia, which is a deprivation of vision. It's oftentimes brought about when one eye is lazy or weaker than the other, and there's different reasons to have that particular disorder, all the way to diseases that are devastating and that we really have no treatment for right now, like retinitis pigmentosa.
Mm.
These are genetic diseases that rob children and young adults of essentially all of their eyesight at a young age, and that's a huge, obviously, burden on that patient as well as the whole family. And that's one of the primaries of research that we have and I have in my laboratory at the University of Wisconsin. And we're basically a stem cell research laboratory. And so we're looking at ways to produce the cell types that die in these diseases so that we can hopefully replace them and better understand the diseases.
So that's some pretty cool research going on, and I'm hoping that you're making some progress. You feel like you are?
Absolutely. We're one of the leaders, if not the leader, in that area here at the University of Wisconsin. We were the first to develop technology to be able to take blood or skin cells from individual patients and engineer them into all the cell types that are present in the retina, including those that die in a lot of diseases like macular degeneration, retinitis pigmentosa, glaucoma. So we're good cell manufacturers. We can produce these spare parts. The trick now is to be able to deliver them and get them to hook up.
Oh, really interesting stuff. Well, as a parent, and there are a lot of parents out there listening today, what do you, let's see, what's the pun here? Keep an eye out for...
You can't avoid puns.
Yeah,
it's impossible to.
I know. Yeah. What about it? For keeping an eye out for your own children's health, eye health, let's put it that way.
Well, a lot of it's some of the basic things that your grandma and your primary care doctor tells you. Health and a good diet is important. But for children, a lot of it comes down to safety. So there's a lot of high-risk activities that people are involved in, and as a pediatric ophthalmologist, I can tell you that the types of emergencies that I see, none of them are planned. So a lot of them, they're all freak accidents. I've never seen someone come in with a bad eye accident that was foreseen. Again, impossible to avoid puns. So the idea of just monitoring what your children are doing, simple stuff that, again, it doesn't seem like it's rocket science. Fireworks on 4th of July. As an ophthalmologist here at UW, none of us like to take call on 4th of July because there's always a number of folks that light off firecrackers. They don't go off. You lean over them. You know,
is
the fuse lit or not? And that ends up poorly a lot of times. Or, engaging in high-risk activities like using projectile weapons without eye protection. Even doing things that are not so kind of... risk-taking, for instance, working with your dad on your car without eye protection and having a metallic object fall into your eye, which is painful, and oftentimes we can deal with that. But again, you just want to be able to think about your eyes when you're doing certain activities and try to protect them as best as possible.
And one more follow-up before we go to the phones here. We'll get to David and Bill and Ann and everybody else in just a bit. But is there a regular... schedule of eye exams for children, just like you have? I know I'm just going through the vaccination calendar for my daughter and making sure that, you know, we're keeping track of all of our vaccinations up to date and so forth. What about for eyes?
Well, I think a big part of that team is the primary care physician. So that child's pediatrician or family care doctor is really on the forefront of making sure that that child's doing the right things with regard to their diet, their activities. And they're also checking their vision as part of their well-child checks. So on top of that, if there are concerns that the parents have or that the child voices, or, of course, if the primary care doctor has, certainly that kicks you right into requiring a thorough eye examination. Outside of that, if everything's going well and there's no family history and the child seems to be progressing well in terms of their vision, every 3 to 4 years is probably a good ballpark just to have a more formal eye exam done.
David in Milwaukee, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. A couple of years ago, I was listening to an eye researcher, I think in the Milwaukee area here, who indicated that blue light was especially harmful to the retina. So I am wondering if that is the case, and if that is the case, then should we limit our exposures to LED lights and also e-devices?
Well, that's actually a question that we get quite a bit. One thing that folks, it's easy to overlook sometimes, is that a lot of studies are done under certain conditions that are not necessarily natural. So they're direct light, or they have very, very high levels of light. And there are certain things that, thankfully, we're put together to protect ourselves against. And, for instance, our natural lens in our eye is a UV protector. So, in general, yes. I mean, you don't want to stare directly at bright lights. You want to give your eyes rest. But, in general, looking at computer screens for retinal damage. Now, eye fatigue is an entirely different situation, but for direct retinal damage, it requires large, large levels of light to be able to cause even the initial indications of of real retinal damage in terms of death of cells. While I think common sense always comes into play,
sure,
and everything in moderation, and if you're outside, sunglasses certainly we recommend. But I think that the level where you have to really change your lifestyle outside of what is common sense, I think is rare.
There we go. Thank you, David, for calling. And Bill in La Crosse, it's your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Glad to talk to you.
You too.
My question is, I have a situation where every now and then I have a fuzzy response when I try to read a line of writing, and it's only maybe one to two words use of that I lose out on, but and they go away after I rest my eyes, but they come back and maybe in two or three days later, the same thing.
Okay, but you're saying that when it does happen, it happens briefly, and if you close your eyes and kind of rest them a little bit.
If I close them long enough, or if I stay away from the reading long enough, yes.
Okay. Well, there's obviously, you guys must love this, but everyone qualifies everyone's answers, right? There's 100 different possible explanations, but I'll mention a couple of the common ones. One is, I'm assuming that you have a bifocal.
Yes, I do.
Okay. And that I have to assume that it's the appropriate strength, and that you're using good lighting and things like that.
Correct.
And what I'm getting at is that if you don't have quite enough a focusing aid or help with regard to near vision, then you could be asking your own focusing system within your eye to do an awful lot. And it could do that, like lifting a 20-pound weight for a little while, but then it gives up the ghost and says, oh, this is too much work, and it will reach a level that's a little fuzzy or foggy for you. So there's focusing issues there. But assuming that that's not the case, probably the most common cause for what you're talking about, and one that's very, quite benign actually, which is good, is a problem with the tear film. So if it's transient, and if you close your eyes and rest them and things get better, what happens when you read or watch TV or do anything that's visually demanding from a task standpoint is you blink less. And as we get older, our tear film, which is actually more than just water, it's got oils and lipids and very important ingredients to it, which allow it to stick to the surface of our eye and stay clean. We lose that ability as we get older, and our tears get a little bit less in terms of their quality. I guess that goes for a lot of things. And so as you're reading, things will get foggy, almost like you get the windshield gets a little bit mushy, or
dirty.
The water on it gets a little bit dirty. And so what to do with that? So what I recommend to folks is that if you're going to do a lot of near work, put some artificial tears in before you start, and periodically as you're reading and doing near work, and hopefully that will obviate that problem. And that's at least a place to start. It's easy, and if it continues to be a problem, then have it checked out.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for those comments.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Bill, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Certainly looking forward to your call and your question as you listen in today as we visit with Dr. David Gamm, who is a clinician and a researcher. Clinical practice is in pediatric ophthalmology. Research interests focus on human retinal development and disease. Directs the UW Eye Research Institute. We'll be back with him right after this look at the news. We're talking about blindness, and there was a really interesting Wisconsin Life piece that relates to this topic. Sight is something you and I take for granted pretty much. Kathy Schneider has been blind since birth, but a lack of vision isn't really the problem she has navigating the world. Let's take a listen.
I don't think much about being blind. I just am and have been so since birth. Like most things, it has its ups and downs. I've had the privilege of working with 9 wonderful seeing eye dogs in my life. But on the other hand, there's a bubble of isolation that surrounds those of us who have visible disabilities that is a pain. Recently, I went to a funeral of an amazing woman at my church in Eau Claire. My yellow lab guide dog and I got there and got in line to sign the condolence book. The isolation bubble began forming for me when the person standing by the book asked, in a surprised tone, if I was sure I wanted to sign the book. Maybe they were holding out a pen toward me, which I didn't see, or maybe the fact that I was digging around in my purse looking for my signature stamp threw them off. I suppressed my tendency to say something snarky and just said, yes, I do. Then the usher seated us in an empty pew and the bubble settled around me. Nobody sat in the row with us. Time passed, the church filled, and still we sat in the pew by ourselves. What were people thinking who knew me but sat elsewhere? There's Kathy and her guide dog. I could sit by them, but I don't usually, so would I have to help them or what? I'll just sit over somewhere else. One of the tough parts about being blind is I can't spot a friend to sit by unless they're talking loudly when I walk in. At parties, I usually roost somewhere and wait to see who comes up to greet me. My guide dog can nose people in greeting who smell interesting, but that isn't always a good thing, depending on where she noses. She often helps in bubble breaking because she's a kid magnet, and then parents come forward to drag the kids away. Friends with other disabilities tell me it's not just blind folks who live in the bubble of isolation. After the funeral, several people said hi, and we chatted briefly as we exited the church. Sometimes the isolation bubble is broken in amazing ways. A fall trip to a local farmer's market to pick out gourds as little gifts for friends is a good example. After having great fun pawing through all the gourds with all their interesting twists and turns, I went to pay the Hmong farmer for my choice gourds. He said, no pay. He was giving them to me. I said, no, I'll pay. He said, no again, and tapped his heart and said, gift from the heart. I have a hard time accepting charity, but this was different. Clearly, he knew the truth of Anne Frank's quote, no one has ever become poor by giving. I relished giving the gourds out and telling each recipient the story of this man who had reached through my bubble of isolation. As I trotted home from the funeral, I mulled over how it could have gone better. Should I wear a sign that says, please speak to me, I don't often bite? We are people of action in Wisconsin. Now that you've heard my story, next time you see a person with a visible disability sitting alone, you'll know how to break the isolation bubble, and I'll bet you'll do it.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit our website at wisconsinlife.org, and you can find us on Facebook as well. So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I hope you take a look around you. A lot of what you know about where you live and work and your ability to do things you love, like reading or watching movies or go for a walk, or obviously closely tied to your sense of sight. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As in all fields of health and medicine, there are advances being made every day in the field of sight and blindness, and today we're finding out about some of those developments with our guest, Dr. David Gamm, both a clinician and researcher, serves as director of the UWI Research Institute. And Dr. Gamm, welcome. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it.
That's great. I'm having fun.
Yeah, well, it's fun to have you with us. So let's go to Ann in Madison. Thank you for waiting, Ann.
Hi, Ann.
Oh, that's no problem at all. I learned so much from the Ideas Network. My niece, who is 25 years old, was recently diagnosed with idiopathic intracranial hypertension, mm-hmm. and has been told that she has too much spinal cord fluid, mm-hmm. and they drained some out, and now she's on medication. But mm-hmm. they said that one of the ramifications of this condition is blindness, mm-hmm. and I wonder what you can tell me about that.
Okay, well, this particular issue is exactly, you've actually got a very good handle on this condition. Essentially, for reasons we don't really understand, thus the idiopathic. Idiopathic has the word idiot in it, and that kind of refers to the fact that we really don't know what's going on. But what happens there is that you have a buildup of the fluid within the brain, and the optic nerve, so the cable that connects your eye to your brain, actually has a sheath around it. So it has a membrane around it that's continuous with the same spaces in the brain that contain the fluid. So if that fluid builds up or pressure builds up, it gets transmitted not only within the brain, which causes headaches, which I'm assuming that your niece had, but it will also kind of compress that cable that goes from the eye to the brain. And long-term compression of that can cause death of the wires that comprise it. There's about 1.2 million wires that carry information from the eye to the brain. And if you squeeze those hard enough and long enough, you can lose them. And that can cause a situation where you have first loss of peripheral vision, which you may not detect, and then ultimately, if it's severe enough and kept unchecked, can lead to severe vision loss. But that's very rare. Oftentimes, it's picked up early. Folks have headaches. They have the appropriate workup done like your niece did. They identify the cause of the problem, and then you intervene to keep the pressures lower. And that can be either acutely by draining fluid, but that's not a long-term treatment. Adjusting diet, adjusting weight. You know, weight loss helps with this as well. And then starting with oral medications like acetazolamide or Diamox, which I'm assuming your niece is on. And that reduces the production of fluid within the brain, and that can be all that you need. And then you just monitor it over time. So people do very well with this disorder if it's diagnosed early and followed closely. So it's not something to worry a lot about. It's something to be, of course, aware of and to follow up with your eye care professional and your doctor about it. But most of the time, almost all the time, it can be kept in check. And if it isn't with typical oral medications, there are procedures that can be done, surgical procedures that can help as well. So there's a lot of layers of potential therapies for your niece. And it sounds like she's getting really good care.
Okay, good. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Elaine in Boston has a question. Well, let's go to Elaine. Thank you for waiting. Hi.
Thank you. I have a 10-year-old granddaughter who was diagnosed with morning glory disc syndrome, mm-hmm. and we're not aware of there being any treatment or surgery for that. Is there some website to watch to become aware if there's anything new with regard to treatment for that?
Well, I'm going to broaden your question a little bit here, and that is what you're dealing with morning glory optic disc syndrome. It's a congenital problem. So at some point, and through no fault of anybody, the optic nerve, again, that cable that connects the eye to the brain, just didn't quite form right while your was it your granddaughter, grandson?
Granddaughter.
When your granddaughter was in her mom's uterus. So it didn't form right. And so it's sort of like it's like a birthmark. But unfortunately, unlike a birthmark on your skin on your back, which doesn't mean much, this is a birthmark that can cause significant vision loss. And it's within a range. Sometimes you have it and you don't even know you have it. And other times it can be more severe and you can be blind in that particular eye. But because it's missing critical parts to the system, there's not a drug that can bring that back, or there's not a surgery that can bring that back at present. But this feeds right into the type of research that we're doing here at the University of Wisconsin, which is producing the types of parts that are necessary to perhaps in the future offer some sort of therapy for these for individuals like your granddaughter. So for example, we're capable at this point of producing those 1.2 million wires that connect the eye to the brain. Well, that's wonderful. And 10 years ago, we couldn't do that. There was no source of that. And of course, you have to have the parts before you can put the car together. But putting a car together is very difficult, too. And so now what we're faced with is a very difficult situation where we can make the spare parts, but how do we get them into the right place? How do we get them to hook up and function again? So there's a lot of hope in this area, but there's a lot of work left to be done. So you're not missing anything. I think a lot of patients that come to me want to know, is there something out there that if they spent enough money or had enough connections, could they help their granddaughter or their grandson or themselves? And the answer to that is no. There isn't anything right now available. But following the McPherson Eye Research Institute website, contacting your local eye care professional, having them inquire is an important thing that you can do to get the information that you need now, feel better that you're doing everything you possibly can, and then watch as we grow and what we learn over time. So that's the best I can tell you right now. I think it's an area that's of extreme importance to us. And then as an aside, very important for your granddaughter is eye protection. So if she has good vision only in one eye, boy, you want to make sure she keeps that. And so, and there, you know, freak accidents happen. And so we always recommend children with low vision in one eye, even if they don't need glasses to see better, to wear what are called polycarbonate lenses so that it offers protection, so that if some child next to her is throwing pencils around, she doesn't take one in her good eye.
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much, Elaine, for calling. I really appreciate your call. Doug was wondering online if you could talk about research on Stargardt's disease.
Yeah, sure. So Stargardt, it's a genetic disorder. It's actually the most common type of central vision loss caused by that you get through your family. The most common cause of central vision loss in general, of course, is age-related macular degeneration. We talked about that earlier and just how prevalent that is in our society and growing. Stargardt disease, named after a physician, Dr. Stargardt, many, many years ago, is similar in that it causes loss of that central vision, but it's you get it because you inherited a gene that doesn't quite work right from, you know, usually one from each of your parents. And so Stargardt disease is in that umbrella group of disorders called retinitis pigmentosa or retinitis pigmentosa-like diseases that affect young people. And so that is a very significant focus of the research being done, again, here at the McPherson Eye Research Institute. And so, again, in that situation, what you have is you have loss of a couple of different cell types within the retina that are genetically not quite right. And they start off okay in many cases, but over time, they just don't hang in there and they die off. And so you're left again with a situation where you're missing a couple of spare parts. Mm-hmm. And your eye, like your brain, at least the back of your eye, your retina really is just an extension of your brain. It's made up of neurons like your brain is. And just like we can't replace the neurons naturally in our brain, so if we have a stroke in our brain and we lose a section of our brain, our brain can't make more of itself. Our retina can't make more of itself either. So using the technologies that we've developed here at the University of Wisconsin, we can make those parts. And in this case, they're called photoreceptors, so the rods and cones that are the initial light sensors in the retina, and then an underlying layer of cells that is important to support them so that they stay healthy. Those two cell types are readily made in the laboratory these days, and we're making efforts to move those towards clinic. And Stargardt's is one of the prime genetic diseases that we're looking to focus on technology.
Oh,
it's actually going on right now. There are clinical trials for Stargardt's using with a replacement, one of those cell types, not the photoreceptors, but the support layer, that are being put into patients right now that have Stargardt disease.
That's great.
Yep.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I'm glad Doug brought that up. Judy in Lodi has a question as well. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Larry and Doctor. I've got glaucoma and macular degeneration. They're inherited from my father's side of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days when my dad had it, there wasn't the equipment they've got now.
Mm-hmm.
But with my glasses, I'm only allowed to get one pair every year in June because of insurance.
I can't talk to you about insurance. Different conversation. That'd be a whole day.
Yeah, it's still the old days on this one.
Yeah.
And I have to wear dark glasses practically all the time because I get extreme migraines also with the eye problem. And then also I've had surgery for three times now on my eyes.
For the glaucoma?
And it's just an ongoing situation. Like, I can't see things close up at all.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like it's getting worse, and I'm scared because I live alone. And nobody else in my family so far that I know has anything like this. Is there anything that they're doing? Because I didn't get to hear the first part of your show. And I was just wondering if there's anything that can be done for any of this that I've got.
Well, there's two levels that we can deal with. One is what's being done to try and help folks like yourself for the future. So, I mean, obviously you are interested in what can be done right now. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, at the McPherson Eye Research Institute, we're interested in both as well. What can we do to maximize vision in individuals that are dealing with diseases like yourself now? And where are the gaps and the hurdles, and how do we overcome them so we can offer more to people down the line? So working on both of those. But I'm assuming that what you want me to concentrate on mostly is what can we do right now. Mm-hmm. Could I ask you real quickly what you're using for your near vision? Do you just have basic bifocals? Do you have any low vision aids?
Yes, I have bifocals, and I think they're trifocals, the whole nine yards.
Okay.
Well, one of the great resources that we have here in the state of Wisconsin is the Wisconsin Council for the Blind and the Visually Impaired. And Marshall Flax is a member of the McPherson Eye Research Institute, and he recently stepped down in his role there. But they have wonderful folks there that work with people that have issues in terms of activities of daily living and reading, riding, getting around, mobility, that have low vision. And I would recommend contacting the Wisconsin Council for the Blind and Visually Impaired, discussing with them what you're dealing with. And they can go over different aids and suggest options for you to improve your visual function.
Yeah.
Located, because I don't have a computer.
Mm-hmm. They're here in Madison. I can't give you the exact the address. I don't have it at the tip of my tongue.
Would my eye doctor know?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. They would know. They are a wonderful resource. I can tell you many states would love to have the level of care and compassion that we have here in this state for individuals that are facing similar situations as yourself.
Yeah, because I've got also an impairment where I'm unable to walk. I have to use a walker if I go anywhere.
Mm. And so that compounds it, right? Our mobility is tied into our vision as well as to our other physical abilities. And you have to look at the whole picture, the whole person, to be able to determine what's best for that individual. And that's what they do very well. And that's why we partner with them. We have a number of our members are part of that wonderful organization, which underscores our commitment to helping people now as well as in the future.
So get in touch with your doctor, and I'm sure he or she is going to have that number and how to contact the council. And thank you again for calling, Judy. Appreciate it. We have time maybe for Richard in Berlin. Richard, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, about 10 years ago, I got hit in the right eye, and since then, I've had a problem with sensitivity to the light. When I'm out in the sunlight or under fluorescent lights, the right temple swells up, I get a severe headache, and my blood pressure goes sky high.
Wow.
Well, that's a toughie because there's so many different things that could feed into that. The main thing that I tend to focus on is there anything you could do to make that better? In other words, are there particular types of glasses with different filters in them that help you?
Mm-hmm.
I wear sunglasses, and I limit my time outside or in under fluorescent lights to a half an hour.
Okay. Well, again, it's one of those things where your best bet is probably determining individually what's best to avoid or what your limits are and trying to stay within those limits. Direct trauma indirect trauma, I should say, to the retina from a blunt force. I'm assuming this wasn't sharp. Was it blunt?
Mm-hmm. I had safety glasses on. And the lens of the glass hit the eyeball.
Okay.
Okay.
So it's blunt force. And you have good vision in the eye? Is it retained, or do you have permanent?
I have excellent vision in
that eye. Okay. Okay. Well, I'm not going to be able to give you a great explanation on that one because photosensitivity or light sensitivity after blunt force injury usually requires a really, really severe hit where you lose vision. So, again, I would recommend avoidance of the situations that bring about your discomfort. And I apologize, I can't give you much more than that with the information.
Yeah, probably getting back to the doctor again and working with your own physician on this would be important. And thank you, Richard, for calling. And Dr. David Gamm, thank you again so much. And thank you for listening. By the way, stay with us. Lots in store.